This week we're discussing the case of the Grim Sleeper.
Tonight we are discussing the wrongful conviction of Richard Rosario.
We're going to talk about the disappearance of Evelyn Hernandez.
We will be discussing the case of the San Mateo Slasher.
Dive into the disappearance of Sneha Phillip.
The wrongful conviction and near execution of Clarence Brantley.
Welcome to Misconduct, a true crime podcast. I'm Eileen, and with me as always is Colleen.
Join us every Thursday as we discuss resolved and unresolved crimes, wrongful convictions, and miscarriages of justice. Find out more at misconductpodcast.com.
In Locust Grove, Oklahoma in 1977, three little girls were murdered less than 24 hours after arriving at Camp Scott near Tulsa. A suspect is named, an escaped criminal named Jean Leroy Hart, which results in the largest manhunt in Oklahoma history. He's captured and arrested, and the case goes to trial. But is everything what it seems? Is the evidence really pointing to Hart as being responsible for the murders? This case has a lot of unanswered questions. There is also a lot of speculative and public views which claimed, and still do claim, that the suspect in the case was not guilty. This case remains unsolved for more than 40 years. Today we will be discussing the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders. Hello, my name is Ali, and this is Insight. Here with me today is Charlie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, this episode will be released on Easter weekend, so we hope all of our listeners are having a safe holiday weekend, and we hope that you have lots of chocolates and true crime podcasts.
Yeah, I hope everyone is having a great Easter.
A little bit of housekeeping before we begin. Charlie and I have also started up some solo projects that we would really appreciate if you could get behind and support. Charlie has Impact Statement that you would have heard the preview for a few weeks ago, and a new history podcast ago, which comes out very soon, Charlie?
In late April. I'm trying to finish all the episodes before I start releasing them.
I have an unidentified persons podcast, The Doe Files, which you all would have heard the preview for last week, and Mysteriously Listed, which is a top 10 themed podcast covering all things unsolved mystery and true crime. All of these podcasts are available on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast apps. Before we start today's case discusses horrific crimes against children. While we won't go into graphic details of the crimes, there is a description of what happened. This episode may not be for everyone, so listener discretion is advised.
In 1977, 10-year-old Doris Denise Milner was a fifth grader at Burroughs Elementary School. She went by her middle name Denise, so that's what we're going to call her tonight. She was being raised along with her sister Kathy by their mother Betty Milner. Denise was one of those kids who was involved in any after-school activity she could be. She did gymnastics, she did tap dancing, she was in the choir. 1977 would mark her first year as a Girl Scout. Denise heard about the summer camp at Camp Scott and desperately wanted to go, which actually surprised Betty, because Denise, even though she was super active, didn't like to be apart from her mother for very long. But she sold cookies to earn the money, and in the summer of 1977, she was packed and ready for camp. On the day she was due to leave, however, she had a change of heart. Some of her friends weren't going anymore, and she didn't want to go anymore either. But Betty told her she had to. She had made the commitment, and she needed to follow through with it. All the girls were traveling to the camp by bus from the Magic Empire headquarters, which is located in Tulsa, which is about an hour away from the camp. So Betty drove a not-so-happy Denise to the drop-off point. Denise was also the only African-American in the group, so she was feeling a little out of place. She told her mother that she was already feeling homesick and didn't want Betty to leave her. So Betty told one of the camp counselors that if Denise was still homesick tomorrow, that she'd come up to camp and get her.
Camp Scott was located 2 miles or 3.2 kilometres from the town of Locust County in Mays County, and that was about 50 miles or 80 kilometres from Tulsa. Camp Scott had been operated by the Girl Scouts since 1928. The camp had a creek nearby and was surrounded by woods. Now, Camp Scott was massive. It covered over 400 acres. The camp got its name from H.J. and Florence Scott, who were well-loved and they were respected supporters of the Girl Scouts, as well as the Boy Scouts in Tulsa. It had 7 campers' tents and 1 counsellor tent in each section, which were separated into age groups, and they were all named after Native American tribes. Each camper's tent wasn't very big. They were each around 200 square metres and they held 4 campers in each tent. And for this first 2-week session in the summer of 1977, more than 130 campers were attending, most of them from the Tulsa area. When the campers arrived on this Sunday afternoon, nothing was out of the ordinary. Well, there actually was, but no one outside the staff and the counsellors of the camp knew that, and no one else would know about the other suspicious events until long after the murders took place. The girls got out of the bus and went into their assigned tents and set up their belongings. The way the tents were assigned were based on the child's age. Denise was assigned to the 8th tent, Kiowa. Now, it's reported as tent 7 in some reports, but the tents were set out in a horseshoe shape, and Kiowa was technically at the end of the line, the closest to the bathroom and kitchen area. And that's really all that is important when we're explaining the scene to you all. Some other information that is important to set the scene of the story. It's been said that Camp Scott was extremely remote. There were no fences for security from outside predators. And Tent 8, the Kiowa tent, was the most remote of all the tents. There is a lot of dense woods and bushes, and because of the way the tents are set out, the counsellor tent didn't have a good line of sight to the Kiowa tent. As I said, it was near the showers and the kitchen, which was between the counsellor's tent and the tent the girls were in, blocking the line of view.
In the Kiowa tent with Denise was 9-year-old Michelle Gousset and 8-year-old Lori Lee Farmer. Michelle wanted to be a teacher like her mother when she grew up. Before she left for camp, she was worried about the African violets she was growing in her room. She had reminded her parents a dozen times to water them. She was really worried they were going to die while she was gone. Lori Farmer had just finished the 4th grade at Jenks Elementary. She was extremely intelligent. She had skipped the 2nd grade, and despite being a year younger than all of her classmates, she still topped the class in every subject. This was to be Lori's first Girl Scout camp, and she was so excited. Her family wasn't as excited because her 9th birthday would fall while she was away later in that week, but that didn't bother Lori. Life was an adventure, and she wanted to experience it. Lori just told her parents, Sherry and Beau, that they'll just celebrate her birthday when she got back from camp. The girls didn't know each other before camp, but as happens at camp, the three bonded quickly. Denise seemed to have recovered from her homesickness and was happy and settled into her new environment. Although in a letter home that she wrote while they were waiting out a storm that night, Denise said that she really wanted to come home. All three girls wrote notes home, actually, and you can find these letters online. They're heartbreaking to read, knowing what is coming in the hours that follow. But all three girls talked about camp, how they had made new friends with the other girls, and they talked about how much they love and miss their families. Now, as Allie said before, there are generally 4 girls to a tent. Well, there's supposed to be 4 in the Kiowa tent, but this girl ended up being placed in a different tent because she was actually younger than what they originally thought. Either it was a typo or some poor math, I don't know. But she was younger than the other girls. She was going to join Denise, Michelle, and Lori the next day.
Now, as Charlie just said, there was a thunderstorm in the early evening, so the girls all stayed in the dining tent doing their letter writing until the storm subsided, and that was about 7 or 8 o'clock. The rain would continue until about 11 p.m. though. The campers always stayed up later the first night. It was so they could get to know each other, and there were songs and stories around the campfire. And then they all went back to their own tents to go to sleep. Everything seemed to run smoothly. Until later in the night, some of the counsellors noticed a flashlight shining in the woods, along with a deep frog-like croaking sound. When they shone the light back at it, the other light went out and the sound stopped. They waited around. They waited for the flashlight to come back on or the sounds to start again, but they didn't. The counsellors eventually gave up and went back to their tent. And then at around 2 a.m, the tent flap to tent 7, the one closest to the Kiowa tent, the tent flap was opened and someone looked in and looked around with a flashlight. It was too dark for the girls to see who it was, and they just assumed it was one of the counsellors checking in on them. Whoever it was that looked in was seen walking towards the Kiowa tent. The only other clue to something happening that night was several later reports of people hearing a scream or someone yelling the words "Mama, Mama." No one heard it again after that one sound, and no one thought to investigate. It becomes especially difficult when it is also reported that there was a girl walking around the camp later that night and she was crying, which you can understand. These girls were still quite young, and it was most of their first times away from their parents. But there is this theory that the scream or the crying out for Mama was actually this girl. But we can't ever know for sure. It could have very well been one of the girls in the Kiowa tent.
On Monday, June 13th, around 6 a.m., camp counselor Carla Willite was out walking towards the showers, which took her past the Kiowa tent, about 150 feet or 46 meters from the tent. Near the base of a tree, Carla saw a sleeping bag, and at first she just thought it was some luggage that someone had left behind or someone forgot, so she went over for a closer inspection. When she got closer, she saw the body of Denise Milner lying on top of her sleeping bag. Denise was half naked, and it was evident that she was dead. Carla obviously panicked and ran to get help. She got the camp director and her husband, Barbara and Richard Day, and they came back with her. Close by to where Denise was, they found two more sleeping bags. It wasn't evident at the time, but when Richard went to pick up the sleeping bags, he realized from the weight that there were bodies zipped up inside. Inside the sleeping bags were the bodies of Lori Farmer and Michelle Gousset. Within minutes, dozens of law enforcement officers arrived, including the Sheriff's Department, Highway Patrol, the FBI, and the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation. Within an hour of the girls being discovered, the crime scene is established. Everything is locked down to prevent any contamination. It really all happened very quickly.
It is the theory of the police that during the night, someone or several someones came through the back of the tent where the three girls were sleeping. The autopsies would later show that Lori and Michelle died from blunt force trauma to the head with a weapon thought to have been a crowbar or a pipe. Their deaths would most likely have been instant. Lori had no bindings on her body. It is thought that she was killed first. Michelle had her arms bound to her sides of her body with a sash cord. According to what investigators think happened, it is thought that she died next. It is thought that both Lori and Michelle were killed in the tent and then moved later. This is supported by blood being found in the tent and these girls being found still in their sleeping bags. Denise was bound with her hands tied behind her back and she was gagged. But by the time she was discovered, the gag had come out of her mouth. Investigators believe that Denise was made to walk to the edge of the camp road where she was found. She was also beaten, but cause of death was due to asphyxiation caused by strangulation, and she still had that cord around her neck when she was found. All three girls were sexually assaulted, and at least two of them were raped. All three of the girls were gagged, and there was an attempt to gag them with a 2-inch wide black duct tape, with the roll being found close by. Time of death was estimated to be between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. This was because the sash cord on the sleeping bags and on the girls were dry, and the rain didn't completely stop until after 11 p.m. Denise Milner's body was at 70 degrees and was warmer than the other two girls, who were already showing signs of rigor mortis. This indicated that she was killed last and at some time after the two other girls.
Near the bodies, besides the sleeping bags, investigators also found a flashlight with a cover over the lens with a pencil-sized hole, which would have limited the amount of light that the flashlight would give off. And the flashlight had a fingerprint on the lens. They also found 3 beer bottles and a crowbar. It is suspected the crowbar was the murder weapon in the crime, but this was never officially confirmed. They also found Denise's clothing and a roll of black duct tape. In the tent, investigators found a boot print in the blood. The boot print is thought to have come from a military-style jungle boot. The parents of girls at the camp heard the news in different ways. Some heard the news over the radio, and they were the ones calling the camp in a panic. Others were contacted by the camp themselves. The parents of the murdered girls were contacted separately. All that the parents of the girls were told was that there was an accident and the girls had died. It was thought that the camp didn't want to break the horrific news of how they died over the phone. There would be some reporting that contacting the parents of the murdered girls wasn't the camp's first priority, that they actually had contacted their insurance first. By the time the camp did contact the three families, some had already heard the news from a media report. All the other parents were told the same thing, that there was an accident, and they were told that their daughters would be brought back on the buses and that they were to pick up their children in the early afternoon. The children didn't know what happened. All they knew was that camp was over and they were going home. They were all kept busy and away from the crime scene until the parents were contacted and the buses arranged. Add to this the confusion at the headquarters with panicked parents and a swarm of media present. The children had found out what happened in basically the worst way possible. Some of the children still suffer PTSD because of the event to this day, more than 40 years later.
Throughout the next few days, investigators scoured the woods looking for clues. They followed up on all leads and conducted hundreds of interviews, but most of it came to nothing. Helicopters equipped with infrared sensors were brought in and hundreds of volunteers joined the search. 2 tracking dogs were brought in from Pennsylvania, but the investigation was hampered by extreme hot weather in the area. Within a week, one of the dogs had died from heat exhaustion and then the other was hit by a car. 2 pigeon hunters who were helping out with the search, they came across a small cave 3 miles or 5 kilometres from Camp Scott. Investigators searched the cave and they found empty food cans and some other items such as sunglasses, a flashlight, newspaper and photographs, all of which indicated someone had been living there at some point. As we said, one of the girls were bound with tape, and the investigators found that this tape may have come from a farmhouse that was only 1 mile or 1.5 kilometres from Camp Scott. In fact, the farmer was arrested and the farm was searched. The farmer was 51-year-old Jack Shoroff. On his farm, they found the roll of black duct tape that was similar to that found near the girls, and the investigators found some rope or cord, and again, this was similar to what they found at the crime scene. Sheriff was taken into the police station and he was polygraphed, which he passed. What was later determined is that Sheriff's farm was broken into and the rope or cord was taken along with the duct tape, 3 bottles of beer and 3 identical crowbars. When investigators went back to Sheriff's farm, they found the same size 10 combat style jungle boot print that they found in the blood in the girl's tent.
A suspect would be named in the murders 10 days later on June 23rd. During that 10 days, Mays County District Attorney Sid Wise called a press conference to announce that a suspect had been charged in the murders. This man was 33-year-old Gene Leroy Hart. Hart was a Locust County native and he was of Cherokee heritage. Hart was already known to the police. He had been previously convicted of rape and burglary. When he was 22 years old in 1966, he was arrested and charged with abducting 2 pregnant women from a Tulsa club and raping one of them. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 3 concurrent 10-year prison sentences. He was paroled after 28 months. He would again be arrested in Tulsa in 1969. This time he was charged with 4 counts of first-degree burglary, which he pleaded not guilty to. He went to trial, was found guilty, and sentenced to a maximum of 305 years in prison. He was also a 2-time prison escapee and had been on the run for 4 years at the time of the murders, since his second escape from the Mays County Jail. His conviction already totaled 300 plus years, and now he's also facing an additional 3 first-degree murder charges. I don't know how hard they attempted to find him after the second escape. I read that there were a number of sightings of him around the county, and these were obvious sightings at the county fair, in the town. He had a lot of support within the Native American community who believed that he didn't do any of the crimes he was convicted for, so no one turned him in and no one gave him back over to the authorities.
As for evidence the investigators had on Hart, it wasn't released at the time, but it did come out later at the trial, and we will get to that later. But there were items found in the cave that allegedly tied Hart to the crime scene. And it was thought that Hart may have been hiding out in that cave. Added to this, Hart was an experienced woodsman and he had family members in the area, including his mother. And with that, the largest manhunt in Oklahoma history got underway. The hunt for Hart stretched out for miles and involved law enforcement, volunteers, search dogs and helicopters. But as days turned into weeks, there was no evidence of his whereabouts. If Hart was still in the area, he was nowhere to be found. Public opinion on Hart's guilt tore the town in two. Checkered past notwithstanding, the number of supporters of his innocence only grew over time. His supporters believed that he was the investigator's scapegoat. He was an easy target to blame for the murders, mainly because he made a mockery of the local law enforcement by escaping from prison twice, and that he was a target because of his Cherokee Indian heritage. On the other side of public opinion, those who believed that Hart was responsible, they helped in raising reward money in hopes that someone would provide information that may lead to Hart's capture. Thousands and thousands of dollars were raised, even from as far away as Florida.
The tips and sightings of Hart eventually stopped and the manhunt was called off. Media interest waned, but then a sighting put the case back into the spotlight. On April 6, 1978, 10 months after the murders, Hart was arrested and charged. He was found hiding out at the property of a traditional Cherokee medicine man named Pigeon in the Cookson Hills. And the way they found him was the investigators threatened the wife of Pigeon with being arrested herself or that there could possibly be retribution against her by other members of the community if she didn't reveal where Hart was being hidden out. Pigeon would be charged with harboring a fugitive, but eventually all these charges would be dropped. The capital murder trial of Jean Leroy Hart commenced in March of 1979, almost 2 years after the murders. Hart pleaded not guilty. There was an increasingly large number of people who believed him. Dinners, merchandise, fundraisers, these all paid for his defense. The Cherokee Nation Tribal Council threw an additional $12,500 in donations. However, the council wanted it to be known that they weren't taking a position on Hart's innocence or guilt. They just wanted to see a fair trial. On March 5th, 1979, the trial began. Everyone in the county seemed interested in what was being said on both sides, because each day, up to 2 hours before that day's session started, people would line up for their seat in the courtroom.
The state's case hinged on two basic types of evidence: hair and sperm samples found on the girls, which expert witnesses testified could be linked back to Hart, and items found in the cave that could put Hart at or near the crime scene. These items included a pair of women's sunglasses that were allegedly stolen from a Camp Scott counsellor, and Hart was known to wear women's sunglasses. There was also a roll of duct tape that matched the tape found at the crime scene, and some photos of two women that could also be linked back to Hart. Also, the cave had some newspaper in it, which was the same newspaper from the same edition of the Tulsa World newspaper that was fitted inside the flashlight found at the crime scene. And you could apparently do that to hold a battery in place. If you wedge the newspaper in with a battery, it helps the battery connect if the battery is the wrong size. Other items of interest were also found at the property where Hart was eventually found and arrested. In the cave, investigators found some graffiti that read, "The killer was here, bye bye fools," and there was a date of June 17, 1977. And it was written with the year first, which is apparently is how someone would write it if they've served in the military. This led investigators to believe this was definitely tied to the case with the military-style boot found at the crime scene. It is also thought that the reference to bye-bye fools is kind of a taunt to the police that they wouldn't be able to find him. I couldn't find anything that would ever conclusively tie this graffiti to Hart. There is nothing to say he ever had any type of military background. It could just have easily been a prank that someone else put there. It might not even be related to the Girl Scout murders. Finally, the cave was known to Hart. It was close to his childhood home. It was a cave that he was seen coming and going from. But it really is more circumstantial evidence, which, as we know, is all the prosecution had to work with. The prosecution argued that the hair found at the crime scene was similar to that of Hart's, and the specimens of sperm found on the girls was not a match to any of the other suspects they looked at, but it was again similar to Hart's. Not a conclusive match, but similar.
The problem with all of this is that it was circumstantial. There really wasn't anything that could place Hart at the camp at the time of the murders. There were no fingerprints, and the biological evidence, the sperm and the hair, couldn't be conclusively traced back to Hart. DNA testing would be another 10 years away. The defense also argued that while the evidence tied Hart to the cave, it didn't necessarily tie him to the crime scene. The newspaper matched, but there were hundreds of that edition sold. The boot print wasn't the same size boot that Hart wore. The fingerprint on the flashlight wasn't a match. None of this proved that Hart was present at the camp when the girls were murdered. The defense tried to turn the public opinion in their favor and claimed the investigators and the authorities had targeted Hart due to his criminal background and his Native American ancestry. that investigators were out to get Hart from the beginning, regardless of the lack of evidence. The history of the state of Oklahoma and the Indian nations made this a believable scenario, whether it was true in this case or not. The defense pointed out another likely suspect, convicted rapist William Stevens, who by this stage was serving time in a Kansas prison for rape. The defense argued that Stevens was a stronger suspect based on his previous crimes and witness testimony. During the trial, a waitress from a restaurant 12 miles or about 19 kilometers from Camp Scott testified that a man that looked like Stevens came into the restaurant at about 5 or 6 in the morning that the girls were murdered. He took off his shirt and kept looking down at his hands. When she went to take his order, he mentioned something about car trouble, and then he seemed to be trying to hide his shoes. He started scaring her with this off behavior, so when he left, she reported him to the local police. A few hours later, about 150 miles away, which would be 240 kilometers, a woman and her son claimed that Stevens came into their home. He was acting nervous. He was dirty. He had a red stain on his boots. He also had scratches on his arm and had a flashlight similar to the one found at the crime scene. Stevens' cellmate, Dwayne Peters, also told his girlfriend that Stevens once told him he had killed the girls while having some type of war game hallucination. Peters and Stevens were friends outside of prison as well, and Peters thought he was capable of committing the crime because he had seen him abduct and rape and beat a woman without showing any emotion.
Although the prosecution did then counter-argue that the hair found on the crime scene wasn't a match to Stevens either, and that Stevens had an alibi for the time the girls were killed, that he was working in Seminole and had witnesses that placed him at work along with a cancelled paycheck and a time card that Stevens was able to produce. And who William Stevens is? Stevens and his girlfriend were both sentenced to 15 years to life imprisonment for the kidnap and robbery of a woman in Garden City, Kansas in November of 1977. Stevens later pleaded guilty to raping the woman, leaving her to die in the trunk of his car. This woman was incredibly strong. She thought that she wouldn't be found in time, so she found a pen and an envelope from a Christmas card in the trunk of the car and then wrote out a description of her attackers. Thankfully, she did survive, and Stevens and his girlfriend were arrested and charged with the attack. On March 29, 10 days after the trial began, the jury retired to make their decision. It would take them less than 24 hours to advise the judge of their verdict. The jury had found Jean Leroy Hart not guilty on all three counts of first-degree murder. The authorities publicly announced in a press conference that they had no plans to pursue any other suspects. They maintained they had arrested the right man and that the trial was a quote-unquote gross miscarriage of justice. We just need to take a quick break for a word about one of our sponsors this week, Brooklinen. Now, my partner is a country boy. He does not care about thread count or materials, just that he is sleeping on comfortable sheets and has a good night's sleep, waking up well rested. He requests that we have Brooklinen sheets on our bed because he says that they are truly the best and most comfortable sheets he has slept in. And that's Brooklinen's philosophy, to make the most beautiful, comfortable home essentials without the crazy prices. With versatile colours and patterns, you really can mix and match to complement your own home decor. This is luxury bedding underpriced. My Brooklinen sheets are the best, most comfortable sheets I've slept on. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code SITE at Brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so confident that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all of their sheets and comforters. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code SITE at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com. Promo code SITE. Brooklinen. These are the best sheets ever.
If Hart was involved, he took the secret with him to the grave. On June 4th, 1979, 2 months after the verdict, Hart was exercising in a prison and he had a heart attack. He was pronounced dead soon after. Even now, 40 years later, there are conspiracy theories as to if Hart actually died from natural causes. There's a rumor out there that cyanide was collected from some inmates on the day before Hart died. But an autopsy did show a severe blockage, and Hart did have a family history of heart problems. An interesting side note, at trial, the defense argued that Hart could not be responsible because he had had a vasectomy, and so he couldn't have left the sperm that was found at the crime scene. However, during the autopsy, it was discovered that Hart's vasectomy didn't take and that he indeed produced sperm.
The Farmers and Milners filed civil lawsuits against the Magic Council, claiming its negligence was partly responsible for the girls' deaths. This was due to the unsettling incidents that occurred leading up to camp that year and the fact that nothing was done to take these incidents seriously. The camp ranger, Ben Woodward, who was the caretaker and he lived at Camp Scott, he found a slashed tent flap with a large section removed from it sometime during the hours before the scouts arrived on that Sunday. The day before that, the camp director's husband came across a stranger walking around the camp carrying a clear plastic jug. During the week before the camp began, one of the camp counselors reported two incidents. Two staff members were followed one night by someone with a flashlight, and in another incident, a staff member saw a man entering their tent. Less than 2 months before the murders, a camp counsellor found a threatening note that read that four girls would be killed at the camp. And on April 1st, 1977, a camp where two troop leaders were staying was ransacked and $53 was taken. The Girl Scout leaders promptly cut the weekend camp short by one day. Also, in the summer of 1976, a Peeping Tom incident had also been reported. And at the time, a lot of these incidents were taken as practical jokes that would normally happen at summer camp, and they weren't taken seriously as possible threats. They were ignored and forgotten about until the next time something would happen, and again, they'd be forgotten about and ignored. In 1985, the case was brought to trial, with the family seeking a total of $5 million in compensation. In the end, the jury ruled in favour of the council, and 2 years later, the decision was upheld by the State Appeals Court.
In the mid-1980s, the then Mays County Sheriff Paul Smith announced they were investigating links to other possible suspects. In the end, nothing came out of it. As for claims in the trial that William Stevens may have been a more suitable suspect, this also eventually fell apart. Besides his hair not matching the one at the crime scene, his cellmate Dwayne Peters recanted his testimony that Stevens confessed to the murders. He said his girlfriend fed him bits of information about the case to make his story linking Stephen to the crime sound more credible. There really is an issue with jailhouse informants in this way because they do have motivation to lie in these ways. Carl Myers was also named as a possible suspect in the murders by the director of a movie based on the murders. John Russell, who made the movie Candles, claims that he interviewed Myers and Myers confessed to committing the murders. Russell also claimed that officials in the county knew that Myers was their guy, but covered up the evidence tying him to the crime. This supports the conspiracy theory that investigators just wanted to pin this on Hart and planted evidence to make it look that way. Myers died in prison in 2012 whilst on death row for committing the first-degree murders of Cindy Marzano and Sean Williams in nearby Rogers County in 1998. They were raped and murdered, and their bodies were both dumped in the Verdigris River. Myers had also previously been convicted for burglary in Oklahoma in 1969, for assault with the intent to commit rape in Kansas in 1979. Now, of course, the investigators would not comment on these claims, and they say everyone's a suspect until proven otherwise. From what I've been reading, it doesn't seem like a lot of people put much stock in this theory, but it's out there and it's part of the narrative.
On July 26, 1989, the FBI lab used what was cutting-edge genetic testing for the time. They put the evidence forward to undergo a procedure called DNA fingerprinting. The technique was developed in 1987 and the FBI started using it the following year. The new test analysed blood and semen, and it's based on the fact that no two people share exactly the same genetic makeup. At the time, scientists indicated that there was a high chance that the test results would be inconclusive, but the FBI made a special exception and broke their rule that they'd only test active cases. DNA fingerprinting is a highly sophisticated method in the late 1980s. These techniques took about 8 weeks to process, and it allowed the isolation of DNA from bodily fluids such as blood, semen, and saliva, and then it would chemically extract them from stained materials. In this case, the evidence used by the FBI included a pillowcase stained with semen, as well as a known blood sample taken from Jean Leroy Hart. In the end, unfortunately, the test was deemed to be inconclusive because the samples were too old and degraded. And then soon after this, in late 1989, a number of DNA tests were conducted on the sperm and hair found at the crime scene. Nothing conclusive would come out of the testing again, though. One test did give some interesting results. From the five aspects of DNA tested from the scene, three reportedly matched those of bodily fluids taken from Hart. Now, only one of 7,700 American Indians would match these samples of fluids as Hart did. But because only three of the five aspects matched, the tests were officially deemed inconclusive.
In 2002, more DNA tests were conducted to extract DNA from the same pillowcase used for DNA testing in 1989, and again, they were not successful. The samples were tested, but they were too deteriorated. A new test had been developed called the polymerase chain reaction short tandem repeated DNA test, and they used that. It had proven in the past to have a good track record with old and deteriorated evidence. I'm not saying I'm an expert on this, but I watched like two Coursera videos about it, and the short explanation is that the PCR test allows single-strand DNA to be turned into double-strand and then duplicated. They can then separate those two strands using heat and create more. This takes a small sample of DNA and essentially amplifies it. The short tandem repeated part of that actually refers to the short repeat units they're looking at. But even after trying twice to get the genetic markers, that test was also unsuccessful. Investigators did pull a partial DNA profile of a female, but the information was only partial and it wasn't enough for comparison to rule out it belonging to one of the murdered girls. Then in 2007, an independent laboratory used by the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation compared DNA recovered from one of the victims with a known semen sample from Hart. The lab used up the entire piece of evidence, destroying it in the process. Unfortunately, no results were obtained from the semen because it was far too deteriorated. But a degraded partial DNA profile, genetically typed as female, was obtained from one of the pillowcase stains. Again, there wasn't enough to determine whether it belonged to one of the girls.
I don't see how it is I guess, important that there is a female DNA on the pillowcases because we know they belong to the girls and we know that the killer had to be a male because of the semen left at the crime scene. One last theory that is frequently mentioned in unsolved murder and true crime forums is a possibility that this crime could have been carried out by more than one person. And I guess this is where the female DNA could become relevant. This is based largely on the assumption that one person could not have been physically able to accomplish or that was involved in carrying out this crime. And that's assaulting and murdering three girls, transporting them a good distance by foot, doing all of this and not being seen and not disturbing or waking anyone up. Also, in support of the multiple killer theory is that the hands of two of the girls were tied using two different knots. Right throughout their investigation, though, law enforcement maintained that they believe Gene Leroy Hart had the strength and the ability to carry out the crime by himself. But really, I think anything is possible at this point. I think it is very close-minded of the investigators not to have considered all other options, and it could have seriously hampered the investigation and stopped them from solving this crime much earlier.
This is a crime that really shook the area. My husband moved to Tulsa about probably almost 10 years after this happened. And when he was a Boy Scout at 14, 15, he went to the camp across from Camp Scott. And that was what they talked about at camp. So this really has been a crime that's haunted the area for a very long time. And with all the DNA options, it seemed really hopeful that at some point the DNA technology would be able to meet the task at hand. But I really think it would be a miracle at this point if we were able to do it because of how deteriorated the samples are and how many of the samples have been used up in all these tests.
I was going to say that, do we have any DNA left at this point? From what I've read, a lot of it was destroyed.
I really think DNA is the key to solve this, but like you said, is there any evidence left to test?
Camp Scott was shut down after the murders, and that Girl Scout chapter didn't have another summer camp for 4 years. Camp Scott is now privately owned and is used for a hunting lease. But in the last couple of years, the camp counsellors and staff that were present at the camp when the murders happened, they have been given permission to make trips back to the camp as part of the healing process.